and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, I guess you could call it a dot plot bombshell. With the shifting of a few dots on a chart of what various Federal Reserve policymakers expect for their benchmark interest rate, as well as Chairman Powell's acknowledgement that it's time to at least start talking about tapering asset purchases, well, the markets are coming to grips with the idea that the Fed's ultra-loose monetary policy may be tightening a little bit sooner than previously thought. What does that all mean for how you should allocate your investments? We'll get into it with a chief investment strategist in Milwaukee. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Katie Greifeld. Katie is a cross-asset reporter and co-anchor of Take Stock on Bloomberg Quick Take. She's an animal lover at heart and celebrates every Friday by tweeting a picture of a hairless cat in a milk bath. No need to rewind, you heard that right. A hairless cat in a milk bath.
You know, Katie, when you actually say the words hairless cat in a milk bath, it makes it sound a lot more kind of weird than it really is, I think.
I would direct people to my Twitter page. It's not as profane as it sounds, I promise. It's just a very relaxed cat enjoying some self-care.
It's some self-care, as we all should on Friday nights. It's a very soothing image. Again, expressed verbally, it sounds a little weird, but it is a soothing image. It always makes me feel like Friday is here, as I know it does the show for a lot of people, which publishes on Friday afternoons. But Katie, talk to us a little bit about Quick Take. How's it going? You're anchoring, what, noon to 1 p.m. these days?
Noon to 12:30. We actually just had our one-month anniversary. It launched on May 17th. So the last month has been kind of a blur, but it's a daily market show, and we're really aimed at retail and individual investors. So a little bit of a different flavor from Bloomberg Television for any Bloomberg Television watchers out there. We definitely try to keep it more geared towards, you know, the individual rather than the institution.
Hey, well, those retail traders, as we all know, are the lords of the market now. So
you can imagine what we've been spending our time on. It's a lot of memes, a lot of GameStop and the like.
the half hour of memes. It should just be all memes, I think. That would be.
We should call it Take Stonk. We've joked about that.
Take Stonk. Nice. Well, let's get into it with the markets discussion here with our guests. Actually, before we do that, one more thing. I've been very remiss in reminding people that we love to hear from you. If you want to give us a call on the Bloomberg podcast hotline and leave us a voicemail, the number is 646-324-3490. And by all means, call in and tell us what the craziest thing you saw in markets this week was, and maybe we will play your voicemail on the show. But let's get to that markets talk. We're very happy to have on the show this week, he is the chief investment strategist at Northwestern Mutual Wealth Management. As I said, he's in Milwaukee, city running pretty hot with the Bucks these days. Don't at me if you're a Brooklyn Nets fan, but they're looking pretty good. Anyway, his name is Brent Schuette. Brent, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Brett, I wanted to get into it a little bit at first with this Fed meeting that we saw on Wednesday. And I'm reflecting back to a note you guys had out, I think it was a month or two ago, that sort of details your asset allocation, some changes you made. Still bullish on equities, but a little bit less bullish than say, the double-fisted buying you might have recommended at this time last year. But I want to read just one quote from this because I think it's pretty pertinent this week. You and your colleagues wrote, you know, while we believe there's ample time left in the economic cycle, we must also be aware that we are progressing at a quick pace, especially in the U.S. And here's the important part. While the Federal Reserve will have a high tolerance for rising inflation, their comfort could wear thin. And boy, I can't help but look at the dot plot this week and see now the median projection for two rate increases in 2023 and a greater likelihood, not yet the median projection, but a higher likelihood of perhaps a rate increase next year in 2022. But to me, I think what the dots really signify, I'm not sure the market is freaking out so much about two hikes in 2023 instead of one, but rather the idea that the tapering might come a little bit sooner than what people were expecting, that perhaps, you know, this Jackson Hole meeting in August will be a sort of a live event where we're going to have to be on the lookout for possible a greater signal that tapering is coming, I don't know, by the end of the year or the beginning of the year. But I'm curious what your takeaway is from the statement and from Chairman Powell's press conference. Did it move the needle at all for you as far as what you're expecting? And given what I read from your note, you kind of were expecting a little bit of sort of cold feet from the Fed, at least some Fed members, as we watch these inflation numbers go higher. A little bit of concern that maybe transitory isn't as transitory as we thought. Well, walk us through your reaction to the Fed this week.
Yeah, so I mean, in many ways, this was right along why we actually made the change that we made, because we knew this was coming at some point. And no matter how many times people tell you the market looks forward and expects things, I think traders still react. And so our base case is that this doesn't change anything. So I will say that the Federal Reserve, I believe, is still who I think they are. That famous quote, I think, from Dennis Green, if I recall correctly. They are going to let this cycle run hot. But people are going to worry more and more about the comment that you made, that the cycle is going to end prematurely. And I still believe it won't, but that doesn't mean that it won't have an impact on markets. And certainly the other reason we took down our equity ratio is because we actually had some pretty explosive returns. And just going forward, I expect those to moderate quite a bit more. The Federal Reserve did something Wednesday, which I'm not for sure they planned to, but it looks pretty brilliant. And so what they did is they really didn't change anything with taper expectations. They bought themselves time and flexibility, actually, to keep the pedal to the metal, so to speak. But they tamped down inflation expectations, which are a big determinant of intermediate to long term inflation. So think about it this way. They're going to keep a policy accommodative. They bought themselves flexibility to stay accommodative, even as inflation rises in the near term, because guess what? The market believes now that they're still worried about longer term inflation. And so that actually tamped those down. You've seen the break-even curve come down, but they didn't say anything with regards to tapering, so to speak. Jerome Powell actually said that they're still a long way away from their labor market goals. And so, you know, I'm not for sure anything changes. And if you look back at the dot plot, when Jerome Powell says take it with a grain of salt, I encourage you to look back on your Bloomberg terminal at the old dot plots in 2012 and 13 and see what they thought rates would be by now, or see when they thought what liftoff was going to be. They missed the mark on more than one occasion. And I keep coming back to the Fed is still outcome based, not outlook based. And so take the dot plot with a grain of salt. And right now the taper is not yet coming, and the Fed bought themselves time to not taper, even if inflation rises, because the market actually took down their inflation expectations.
So Brent, I mean, you mentioned that they were able to actually tamp down inflation expectations, and you did see a big move lower in break-evens on Thursday. And you also saw a huge flattening in the yield curve, particularly the 5s 30s curve. I think at one point, I mean, it's the biggest move since late February. Could you walk me through that market reaction? I mean, does that just go hand in hand with what you're saying, that you're seeing such a big rally in the long end of the Treasury curve just because the Fed was able to do some fancy footwork and manage to bring down those inflation expectations?
Yeah. So, I mean, the crazy thing to me, and I know you're going to ask me that at the end of the show, but the crazy thing to me is that traders are trading as if this is the end of the cycle. And we're talking about 2023 for the first rate hike. Consider that 2 years away. This is much, much different than the Fed tightening the economic environment into a recession. We're just talking about tapering. And we're not talking about the first rate hike to 2023. And so to me, you know, the Fed got what they wanted. They brought inflation expectations down, but they're able to keep policy extremely accommodative. And the crazy thing is that traders are trading it as if we are now at the end of the cycle, which kind of back to Mike's comments in the opening, I don't think we're there yet. But the traders are reading the playbook, and that says buy long bonds. I think this will be long forgotten in a couple of months. I do think you will see rates move higher. I do think you will see cyclical stocks move higher. And I think the defensive stocks that are rallying or that rallied in the past week based upon the Fed perceived turn will actually not be the market leaders.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the most dramatic reaction, at least on Thursday, the day after the Fed, was just this massive flattening of the yield curve, which, you know, in theory should take some of the wind out of the sails of the stars of the cyclical trade, the financials. But It sounds to me like, do you think it was just a sort of a positioning washout that we saw this week, and we'll, like you said, we'll forget about it in a few weeks, or is it an overreaction? How do you make sense of what we've seen this week?
Both of the above. I think it's a positioning washout as well as an overreaction. I don't think much changed with the Fed. To me, they're still outcome-based, not outlook-based. I think they want to keep monetary policy as easy as possible, as long as they can. I think they bought themselves some time with this in an ironic way. But to me, the Fed shifted last year. The Fed that I knew for the prior years of my career was lurching in that way. And last year, they put it more in stone, where they're actually going to target inflation above 2%. The mandate post the 1980s was one mandate. That was inflation. Employment was secondary. Now we've swapped those. Employment is first, inflation is secondary. And the Federal Reserve is not going to stop until they get everything they possibly can out of the labor market, even if that means risking higher inflation. And so to me, the backdrop from both monetary and fiscal policy is still highly accommodative in the future. And that meeting didn't shift that, in my belief of that.
Dig in more on what the read through for equities is. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, you're still optimistic on cyclical stocks. You know, this move into defensives that we're seeing maybe is overblown. Where do tech stocks fit into all this, and particularly the FANGs? I mean, I read a lot of commentary on Wednesday after the Fed meeting that this isn't good for, you know, the speculative corners of tech. But what about just those, you know, cash cow companies, Apple, Amazon? What does it mean for those blue chip companies that are probably going to make money in any environment?
Yeah, I think there's still opportunities there. I agree with you. And one of the ironic things last week was that those hopes, dreams and themes tech stocks actually did rally post the Fed meeting based upon, I guess, the view that lower rates are going to help them. And that's where you have to go for potential earnings growth. Which I still think the cyclicals, if you believe my story that we're still in a cyclical upswing, that the economy hasn't even peaked yet, and that it still has time to run for some time, I still think cyclicals have room to run. Now, the FANG stocks, the older technology stocks, you know, there's probably still some value there. But I think, you know, from the standpoint of where we're focused, it's more towards the value segments of the market, the cyclical segments, and increasingly more so places like the Eurozone, which benefit from a cyclical growth upswing around the globe, which I think is occurring as COVID restrictions come off in some of those economies.
Yeah, also interesting, Brent, you guys, you're only overweight in the U.S. Recommendation is U.S. small caps, which, you know, I assume it's part of the makeup of the indexes, a lot of banks, a lot of sort of more cyclical type of companies, less obviously no mega cap tech, but even less, you know, tech in general. You know, is it all sort of the industry makeup, or is that the primary driver of where you're finding value around the world? But or is it for, say, U.S. small caps? Is there embedded in that sort of a call on risk tolerance? And with Europe, too. I mean, obviously, European banks, you know, famously sort of risky. You know, is it kind of an animal spirits call as much as it is cyclical, and sort of what is makes up the majority of the weights in these indexes?
Absolutely. I mean, there is something about what makes up the weights in these indexes. But, you know, typically small caps do well in the beginning to mid part of an economic cycle. And I think we're still there, even though, as you mentioned, the question that we have is how quickly do we progress? I still think we have time. We're early on. Valuations are cheaper relative to large cap. From the standpoint of real interest rates, small cap stocks really like negative interest rates, and I think we're going to continue to have those for some period of time. You know, I think everybody wants to run back to the safety of large cap growth, or the perceived safety of large cap growth, because they did so well for the past couple of years, and maybe even longer than that. But I just think this economic cycle is going to be different than the past. And in this one, you're going to worry more about upside risk to growth, upside risk to inflation, not downside. And I think you have, you know, back to risk tolerance, you have a Federal Reserve that, you know, I know what happened the other day, but this Federal Reserve needs the market to move higher. The markets and the economy are connected. They've done that by doing QE. And I just think you have a risk backdrop that's favorable for small caps for some period of time. You know, I think if you look back historically, the explosive move is probably over in small caps, cyclicals, and value. But I think everyone gets it wrong about how long this typically lasts. If I look historically, those types of things continue to outperform until the Fed starts aggressively raising rates or the yield curve inverts. And I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. And so I think you still have time to run in that trade. Now, we did take a bit of it off because I could be wrong. And part of this job is realizing that you have to be humble and that you're playing trade-offs. But I still think it has time to run. And I think if you look at Europe and where Europe is, they're a bit behind the curve. They had negative GDP in the first quarter. And they're just emerging from COVID lockdowns. And that, back to your index composition, their indexes are really cyclical in nature, and they really benefit when global growth ticks higher, which I think we're moving from more of a U.S.-centric to now the globe being much more in the growth mode. And that should favor international equities. And I think the Eurozone is primed to be a part of that.
So Brent, you brought up index composition, and this is one of my favorite topics. And I have to bring in the meme stocks at some point. And I mean, when you look at the Russell 2000, the small cap index, its biggest weights are AMC and GameStop right up there. And I mean, if you really dissect a lot of the performance, I think both of those stocks are still the biggest contributors to the index's gain. I mean, as a manager, how do you, you know, invest around that? That you do have these stocks totally disconnected from fundamentals, sort of just ballooning in these indexes. I mean, do you just try to ignore it, or how do you factor that in?
No, certainly. I think you tear apart the performance and you look and you see that there's a lot of other things in the indexes. And we use the S&P 600. So it's a bit different of a composition than the Russell 2000. But you look and you realize that that is a decent sized part of it. But there certainly are other parts to it. The other thing that I'd say is that active management could have the ability to add value above and beyond, just because sometimes performance is created by avoiding certain things, not just what you buy. And so I think there's a couple of messages there. And I've made reference to this in prior interviews that I do think this reminds me a lot of the late 1990s. And I should add that post 1999, 2000, that a lot of stocks that hadn't done well or that weren't overbid actually did very well during that supposed lost decade. And active management also did very well during that time period because the market broadened out beyond just a few names moving each and every one of the indices, kind of what we've seen over the past couple of years.
You know, Brent, I'm curious just anecdotally what it's like working for a firm like yours in this era of the meme stock craziness. I mean, you guys have a lot of advisors out there who are, you know, in contact with individual retail investors, you know, daily. You know, is the phone ringing off the hook with people asking about why can't I get Dogecoin, or should I buy AMC calls? Does it change the mindset of your clients when all this stuff is going on?
You know, I certainly have heard a lot about cryptocurrency. So that's been, although a lot less lately, yeah. Not surprisingly. Yeah. The meme stocks I haven't heard too much about, although I'm sure the advisors are answering questions. You know, I think we're a firm that's focused much more on blocking and tackling and overall asset allocation and the importance of planning in that aspect rather than what's the hot stock of the day. And our advisors do a great job of planning, combining insurance and investments. And so I'm sure those conversations are happening. But they certainly haven't filtered through too much to me, although, I hear a bit about cryptocurrencies, and certainly we've heard a bit about AMC and GameStop, but more from the perplexing commentary, not necessarily, I want to buy this. They're trying to make sense of it, and is this something they need to be doing? And I think the answer has been, for the most part, no. And I think that's acceptable for our clients just because they're more grounded in the fundamentals of how you actually grow wealth, which is more along the blocking and tackling of saving, investing in a diversified portfolio, and protecting your assets, from the bad things that happen in life.
Brent, one thing I found interesting in your allocation note that was out recently is the discussion of emerging markets. Because at first blush, I think, well, if you're bullish on inflation, if you're bullish on cyclical and value stocks, that you'd probably be bullish on EM. I mean, just looking at the EEM ETF as a proxy, real heavy weighting to banks and financial services, decent size weighting to energy, commodities, that sort of thing. And as far as tech, a big weighting to chip makers, obviously Korea and China and whatnot. But you guys are a bit more cautious about emerging markets in an inflationary environment. So walk us through why that is. Why is this not really the best place to be in this type of cyclical, possibly inflationary environment?
Yeah, and that's it's kind of a base case discussion versus a what if discussion. If you think about emerging markets, if inflation were to be more persistent, they would probably be hit hardest and first. Just because a lot of those countries don't control their monetary policy per se, and they oftentimes have to raise rates when inflation rises and money starts flowing out of their economies, and that actually harms them, and you can actually have a currency crisis. And so, you know, we still do have a modest overweight, a very minor overweight to EM. It's much less. So I guess that trade was twofold. We took mid caps down to decrease our equity ratio, and then essentially we moved some of our emerging market overweight into the Eurozone, thinking that they had much more control over their monetary policy than some of those emerging economies do. And so again, I bring it back, and I think people think this job is all about trying to get everything right all at once. It's kind of the opposite in many cases. We're managing risk. And so while I may have some risk on one side, I may want to actually take it off on the other side or figure out where I can get the same exposure with less risk. And so I think of it that way. It's just more of an acknowledgement that I do think this bout of inflation that we're having right now is more transitory. But I do think it could become more permanent. And if that were to be the case and it would run away, I think emerging would be amongst the first, to be hit and to be hit pretty hard. And so we wanted to take some of those chips and move them more towards developed international markets, which have a lot of the same characteristics and are tied to global growth, but actually have, you know, the European Central Bank, who can choose more so to do what they want rather than be forced to tighten because the Fed is tightening or something of that nature.
And Brent, I want to shift gears a little bit and ask you about real estate, because it also caught my eye in your investment allocation that you are unfavorable on real estate. And this is a market I know very little about, just to be completely honest. But I mean, it's been hard to miss headlines about just how hot the housing market is. You know, it feels like there's just zero housing supply, and everything it takes to build a house also costs a lot. Walk me through your call there. I mean, is that market just too hot to touch?
Yeah, so real estate is much more than the housing market. It's certainly office REITs, storage REITs, things of that nature. And so there's a lot more to it than the housing market. And certainly, you know, to me, and I'm just back in the office for the first week this week. I mean, to me, real estate was the asset class that had the most COVID tail to it. And so how do companies react in the future? What does the world look like? Do people go back into offices? Do we need the same amount of office properties that we had in the past? Rent abatements, what happens there? And so we were actually max underweight REIT going into COVID. That was lucky. And that was a different call. And then we recently, so the asset allocation that you're reading, the one before that in January, we actually upped our REITs from max underweight to slightly underweight. But to me, REITs, they certainly rallied recently. They are more of an income play. And if you look historically, they trade almost based up like long bonds, at least in the past 4 or 5 years when the Fed has really tied this to keeping rates low. And this is where I guess tourist investors who are looking for income went there. And whenever the yields would rise, they would bail. And so, you know, think of it this way. If you look back to 2013 and you're worried about a taper tantrum, you want to know the asset class that sold off the most? REITs. They fell a lot. And that's just because they trade as if they're long bonds and they trade based upon yields. I could show you a chart that shows you the S&P, for example, divided by REITs, and you can overlay the 10-year treasury, and they're almost moved exactly alike for the prior 3 or 4 or 5 years. And so, we've warmed more to REITs, so that we did buy them back in January. The one area that I think, and I think I've made mention that I think yields could rise more, but one of the things that could happen over the summer, I think about the Eurozone, think about government debt all around the globe, think about negative yields in Germany. If the Eurozone starts recovering, might those yields in Germany move higher, which would allow some U.S. yield movement higher? And our thinking is if that were to occur, possibly that would be an attractive point to re-enter REITs because they are so income sensitive. I would imagine they would sell off in that scenario.
Well, Brent, one thing we are very much overweight on in this show is the crazy things that we've all seen this week. So I hope you came prepared. I know they warned you about this, our crazy things segment.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
But let's get started with Katie. Katie, I have high hopes for your crazy thing. What's the craziest thing you saw this week?
All right. So this is crazy. I don't totally understand it because it has to do with DeFi. But this is a blog.
I'm lost already.
Decentralized finance. It's like, I've asked so many people to explain it to me. It still won't quite click in my brain. But there's this token, the DeFi Titanium token. It was trading around $60. Now it's zero. But the crazy thing is that Mark Cuban had put out this blog post about how excited he was about DeFi, how he was providing liquidity to this token. So it wasn't that he necessarily held it. I hope I'm understanding this correctly, but he could collect a fee on the volume, but now it's at zero. So that's pretty amazing. It's just, I feel like this perfect little illustration of how kooky the crypto space can get.
Yeah. Yeah, I read about that. Yeah, there's some arbitrage trade that's automated between that token and some other token. I don't understand it either. And I think the real moral of the story is Mark Cuban didn't understand it clearly. And so, but when I saw it went to zero, I was like, okay, I'm a buyer. I'll take all of it.
Yeah.
I'll take it all. But it must be like, not quite zero. It's got to be 0.00. There must be a one in the decimal place somewhere that I would imagine. Because who's selling it for zero? I don't know.
Amazingly, I can't get a price for it on the Bloomberg terminal. They haven't put that in there yet. I don't think we have Doge either yet.
We still don't
You don't. Yeah. There's no Doge in there. I've looked for it a couple times.
Yes. I don't know if that's a good or bad idea on our part. I'm leaning towards a good idea, I guess. But Brent, I don't know. Katie came pretty big there. That's a good one. Do you have something that's crazier than that? I know you teased something for us at the beginning.
Yeah, no, I just think, I mean, that's more tame probably than, I don't know if it's crazy, but I think it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy to me that every meeting that we go into the Fed, people say it's the biggest Fed meeting ever. And then people choose to trade it. And then, you know, a few weeks later, we'll forget about it. And the next meeting will be the big one.
And
I just think it's crazy that people are trading the end of an economic cycle when you think about the dots being moved forward and their record historically is not very good.
Yeah.
I just think that's kind of crazy, I guess. I certainly think it's still crazy that one person can tweet about a cryptocurrency and cause it to move as much as that person does. And that probably shows, Katie, it kind of ties back into what you just mentioned. I mean, there's 10,000 of these cryptocurrencies, I believe. And when one person can move it, kind of shows you how immature the whatever this is, asset class still is. But I thought I'd maybe end with a comment and a question that I get quite often more this week. And I saw it actually maybe pop up on one of your blogs potentially, where someone asked, you know, with regards to inflation, the question that is coming up quite often is, well, do you think these companies are just going to roll back their prices? Now, I want you to think what inflation is and how we measure it. So inflation is a year-over-year measure. If these companies don't roll back their prices next year and they stay the same, inflation will be zero. So I think people just need a little bit of a math reminder that even if they don't roll back their prices and they keep them at these elevated levels and they're the same next year, that's not inflation. That's actually zero inflation.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess that's more of a math thing and a question that I'm getting quite often. And I don't know if it's crazy or not, but it certainly struck me as a bit crazy.
Well, no, I agree with you. And I keep thinking that we're going to be talking about transitory deflation, or disinflation, at least at some point next year, when that exact thing happens, that, you know, everyone plays catch up and just leaves prices where they are. The commodities that were running hot go down a little bit, you know.
The base effects work the opposite direction next year, right? This year you had higher inflation. Last year you had lower inflation.
Yep. Yeah, that's pretty good. And to your point about it being crypto being an immature asset class, which I agree with, especially when one unnamed person can move it, whip the market around as much as they can. It's mature, though, is the amount of money involved in the market caps of some of these. That's what's fascinating to me. It is a very immature asset class, but yet the assets are there. So it's kind of a scary thing when you think about it.
Yeah, the stakes are much higher than they were in 2017. Now that you have, you know, a lot of Wall Street actually getting involved and putting real money into it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. The stakes are higher. All right. Well, I'll give you my crazy thing, and it is I'm delving back into the crypto space myself. You know, the president of El Salvador obviously made a lot of headlines by declaring Bitcoin legal tender. This, I think, is even crazier and more interesting. I'm not sure I would even call it crazy. I think it might be crazy like a fox. It might be a stroke of genius. He is suggesting that they use El Salvador's volcanoes as a source of power for Bitcoin mining. Obviously, the energy intensive use of these Bitcoin miners is a hot topic these days, causing Elon Musk to sort of take a step back away from it. But El Salvador does have a pretty, what sounds like a robust geothermal energy infrastructure and some power plants that aren't running at capacity. Why not mine Bitcoin off of the volcanoes of El Salvador? I don't know. I've heard crazier things, I think, but I like it. I like that outside of the box thinking. But it makes you think, Katie, you know, if that's where the mining's going to go eventually, is to countries that are able to produce the energy in some less provocative way than, say, burning coal or oil.
I was going to say, I guess, you know, volcano-powered Bitcoin mining, that counts as green. That's, you know, a renewable source of energy, theoretically. I don't know. I hear the phrase volcano-powered Bitcoin mining, and, like, my brain refuses to process
it. Like, what could possibly go wrong?
I just can't wrap my mind around it. But that, I mean, that's, I can't wait to watch how that evolves.
Me too. And that story, courtesy of CoinDesk, by the way. I like to give credit where it's due. But with that said, Brent Schutte, Katie Greifeld, thank you so much to both of you for coming on the show. Really enjoyed this conversation, and hopefully we'll have you back again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Katie Greifeld is at K Greifeld. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.